Hi, everybody. I'm Beauty Combs Redout, and welcome again to the Ask Beauty Show. And isn't it the truth, my friends, particularly with what's been going on with the coronavirus in the last couple of months? We certainly all need somebody to talk to. You know, when you think about it, it was just a couple of months ago and we were all really looking forward to spring and walking around outside and playing tennis and jogging, and look at how things have changed for all of us all around the world. I mean, people's concerns now are, you know, what about my family? Am I going to be at risk for the virus? Is my family or family members going to be at risk? Am I going to have a job that I love, a job that I've worked at for many, many people for years and years? Am I going to lose my business? Look at how many small businesses are on the verge of closing, and not just closing temporarily, but for many businesses, the businesses are going to close forever. Am I going to be able to pay my rent, to put food on the table for my family? Will my children be able to go to daycare or go to school rather than just have them zooming in on the computer? Am I going to lose my health care benefits? And for so many people who are actually fortunate to have health care benefits, the question then becomes, will my benefits, are they sufficient benefits to be able to cover unexpected kinds of illnesses? Am I going to be able to hug my friends and family members and not just over the screen? And, of course, the big question for all of us is that will life ever, ever get back to what it was? Now, to be fair, I've spoken with a number of people who have been not that upset about what's going on. They're reading, they're writing, they have found a way to build a brand new routine for themselves. And I think for those people, you know, that's a really terrific thing. But for the majority of people, certainly according to the United Nations, they warned that the coronavirus pandemic is generating a real mental health crisis as millions face isolation and poverty and anxiety. Domestic violence, as an example, is rising, and healthcare workers are reporting an increased need for psychological support. And I was looking at statistics around the world, and I think many people think, well, what do we really care about what's going on in China or in other parts of the world? But we've seen an increase of prevalence of distress of 35% of the population surveyed in China, 60%, in Iran, 45%. In the United States, the statistics are also really, really rising. Suicides are up. And there are some surveys that were actually done in my country, in Canada, where 47% of healthcare workers reported need for psychological support. 47%. That's almost half of all the people who live in Canada. In China, as an example, we have different figures for depression. 50%. For anxiety, 45%. Insomnia, 34%. Pakistan, 42%. So the numbers there, these are just preliminary numbers that we know right now. And here in the United States, tens of millions of Americans say that the coronavirus is harming their mental health, with more than a quarter of Americans polled by the Kaiser Family Foundation reporting a, quote, major impact. A federal emergency hotline for people in emotional distress registered more than 1,000% increase in April compared with the same time last year. And calls to suicide hotlines are massively, massively up as well. And I think that at least people realize the importance of reaching out when they are feeling so, so low and when their lives and relationships are feeling so out of control. Americans are doubling down also on their worst habits to cope with emotional stress related to the virus. For example, alcohol sales, they have jumped up, with spirits 75%, wine up 66%, and beer 42%. Cannabis reached an all-time high in March, even though experts warn us that marijuana and vaping and tobacco may increase, not decrease, but may increase the risk of the virus. People are also exercising less and eating more. Hopefully with the nice weather, we are going to get out more. We'll be wearing masks and gloves. And I was walking around Riverside Park just yesterday with Cha-Cha, our dog, and it was really nice to see people. They were really watching the distance, you know, that they had between other people, but they were walking and jogging, and the sun was shining, and it certainly helped to improve all of our moods. There also may be long-term effects of PTSD, post-traumatic stress disorder, depression, and anxiety. But if you find that you're judging your responses or your emotions, remind yourself that the ups and the downs and the worries are all very, very normal given these circumstances. And if you feel overwhelmed, focus on breathing instead of reaching for your phone, and instead of social cutoff time. But you know what? I also have been looking at this as a time for all of us to really reevaluate our lives in all kinds of ways. How do we want to live? What kind of changes? What kind of changes do we really want to make? So it is a good time to reevaluate and for many people to reset. I hear that more and more people who've lived in New York for many, many years are actually considering moving to the suburbs, moving to quieter places, moving to a place where we're not in the middle of the pandemic. But one of the things that I always like to do is to think about the lessons to be learned and things that we actually can do. I mean, there's certain things that we have absolutely no control over. But on the other hand, there are a lot of things that we do have control over. For example, finding a support group where you can feel comfortable to honestly express your feelings of anxiety and worry and depression and sadness and anger. So you really need to give yourself permission to be authentic with yourself and others, and it can make all the difference in the world. I know that many women's organizations that I'm a part of were having these Zoom parties, and just to be able to see some of the people, your colleagues and your friends, even if it's just for an hour, it makes a big difference, and it can really help to lift our mood. Another thing that I recommend, and I've really been trying to do in my own life, is to create a daily routine to help normalize our lives. For example, I find that getting dressed, doing my makeup and hair, even though I have absolutely no place to go, eating breakfast, taking my vitamins, and exercising and lifting my weights is a really, really great way to start the day, since I'm seeing all of my patients now either on Zoom or on Skype or on the phone. And we do need to be aware of the things that we can do to keep ourselves relatively sane and safe. Again, washing our hands, maintaining the 6-foot social distance recommendation, wearing masks. So these are things that we do have control over, and these are things that are really in our best interest. And we also have to keep in mind the importance of eating healthily, since we need to keep our immune systems, and of course Gary Nowlin, he tells us about this every single day, strong, and keep a check on how much sugar and alcohol that we are consuming. And exercise, exercise, exercise. And, you know, I think a lot of us have discovered that we don't need to go to a gym to keep ourselves physically and mentally in shape. And I love some of the online video workouts. You really want to check them out. And also be aware of getting sufficient sleep. And also, I think it's really important to, of course, be aware of current government updates. But I do not suggest that we glue ourselves to the television or computer 24 hours a day. You know what? We can check for updates a few times a day. Nothing is going to change probably in our own lives between, you know, 12 o'clock at noon and 6 o'clock in the evening. And, it, you know, it becomes enough. Otherwise, our anxiety levels, you know, can really, really get out of control. And for those of us who are living with partners or loved ones virtually 24 hours a day, we really need to learn to respect each other's boundaries and communicate and say, listen, darling, I love you very much, but I really need some space, and to give yourself permission to not only say it, but to put your wishes and your needs into action. And many people find that meditation is very, very soothing. And if you've never tried it, there are many online videos that can help you get started. And if meditation is not for you, that is okay too. And finally, you have to give yourself permission to reach out and ask for professional help when, despite all of your wonderful, wonderful efforts, your life continues to feel out of control. And I think it's a good thing that people are giving themselves permission to reach out to hotlines and teletherapy. There's so many now online therapy sites. Of course, we always have to be careful who it is that we are going to be engaging in. And finally, and I found this to be really very, very relevant in my own situation, is that science offers a simple, I don't think it's so simple, but a simple and effective way to bolster our own emotional health. And you know what that is? To help yourself, start by helping others. And that really can make all the difference in the world. Well, now we are going to change to a completely, completely different topic, a topic that I actually never thought about discussing on the Ask Beauty Show, and that is electroconvulsive therapy. So how did this all come about? Well, on May the 5th of this year, I received an email from a woman whose name is Deborah Schwarzkopf. And she asked me whether or not I would be interested in doing a show on ECT. And I said to her, I've been practicing now for over 35 years, and in the 35 years I had only one patient in Providence, Rhode Island, who went through the electroconvulsive therapy treatment. It was very successful in her particular situation, and I've not given the subject, to be perfectly honest, much of any thought, but I thought this would be really intriguing for me to do some research and for me to speak to some psychiatrists and neurologists and to explore the subject, because one of the things that I really like to do, and it's important to do on the Ask Beauty Show, is to have balanced conversations about controversial issues. So I did a little bit of research, and I discovered that there are 100,000 people every single year who are receiving the treatment, people who are primarily in general hospital psychiatric units. And I did some homework. I spoke with some doctors, and so I decided that today would be a really good day to have a good and perhaps controversial discussion about ECT. So I have three terrific guests. My first guest is Dr. John Breeding, and he is a psychologist with a well-established private practice in Austin, Texas. And Dr. Breeding has been active for about 20 years in challenging the psychiatric practice of electroshock. He served on the advisory board of the World Association of Electric Shock Survivors for many years and was instrumental in the passage of significant legislation providing protection for Texas citizens regarding the use of electroshock in Texas, which is one state that actually bans electric shock on children under age 17. I'm not sure why anybody would want to administer this treatment to children, but he is also a founding member of the Coalition of the Abolition of Electroshock in Texas. He's written 5 books. And we're going to have a very interesting discussion with him in a couple of moments. My second guest is a woman, Sarah Price Hancock. And Sarah is a certified rehabilitation counselor, a former adjunct professor at San Diego State University's internationally recognized rehabilitation program. She is an activist, and she is, above all, a 10-year survivor of 116 bilateral ECT treatments. And finally, and this was a conversation that I had yesterday afternoon with my friend, my good friend, Dr. James Gilligan, who, of course, we know is the husband of Carol Gilligan, who is an author and a feminist and an ethicist and a psychologist and a friend. And Dr. Gilligan is a world-renowned psychiatrist, researcher, and author of a series of books entitled Violence, where he draws on 25 years of work in the American prison system and describes the motivation and causes behind violent behaviors. So we have quite a group with us right now. So first of all, welcome everybody. I know we're on the phone. It would be easier if we were at the studio, but we're going to have to just make the best out of our new reality. So let's start with Dr. Breeden. First of all, welcome, Dr. Breeden.
Hello. Thanks for having me on.
Hello, it's really nice to have you here on the Ask Beauty Show. So I was very, very curious how you actually started to become interested in the whole issue and subject of electroconvulsive therapy, and what led you to become an advocate challenging a procedure that so many people say is very, very effective in treating serious depression and other serious, serious mental health disorders that have not responded to medication and psychotherapy.
Right. Okay. Well, I've been a psychologist for maybe 37 years, and I'm 68. And one thing that I discovered in my beginning work as a psychologist was that a lot of the things that I'd been taught about counseling and working with people were relevant in terms of people wanting help, you know, with psychological distress and relationships and other issues and things like that. But I also discovered that a lot of people felt like they'd been hurt by prior experiences with the mental health system. And so I was faced pretty early on with realizing that my profession was kind of mixed, in the sense that we helped a lot of people, but we also hurt a lot of people. And so I decided, okay, so here I am, a mental health professional, and I'm in a profession that has some pretty mixed results, and it's one of the few professions where you have a large numbers of people who were reaching out for help and ended up becoming activists against various aspects of my profession. And a couple of those, so that covers a lot of ground, but a couple of those areas, one involved the drugging of millions and millions of children in this country, and that became one of my issues, and one that many people, many parents and also children, once they grew up, became activists around, feeling like that hurt them and was an injustice. But the other big one that fell into my lap was I started having occasional clients here and there who'd had electroshock and felt like it really hurt them. And then I got to know more and more electroshock survivors as I started exploring that, and just that term, you know, electroshock survivors as opposed to electroshock patients and beneficiaries, you know, it just pointed to this area that was, as you said, extremely controversial and thorny. And so I kind of got recruited to help with that, and decided that, you know, one way I could stay in the profession and sort of figure out my ethics with it was to sort of transfer my previous activist energies, which were more involved in issues like disarmament and war and peace and stuff like that, and just transferred it over to working on issues of what we call mental health system oppression or whatever aspects of my profession that were hurtful. And so that's how I got into that, and then specifically electroshocks, you know, and a couple of electroshock survivors who started the World Association of Electroshock Survivors sought me out because I think I'd made a couple of comments or written a newspaper article on it, and I got involved, and one thing led to another. And then I, you know, as your introduction let it be known, you know, I have a group that was called the Coalition for the Abolition of Electroshock in Texas, so that pretty much identifies my position as an right. abolitionist, you know.
You know what? I would really like at this point for Dr. Gilligan to weigh in. We can kind of summarize the conversation that we started to have yesterday afternoon. So welcome, Dr. Gilligan. And, of course, you and I, we were talking about electroconvulsive therapy in very different ways than Dr. Breeden is. So why don't you just give us your thoughts and experience and research and knowledge on this particular issue?
Well, sure. Actually, I am not sure there's actually such a major disagreement between us here.
Let me just say, I can't hear Dr. Gilligan.
I would say, hi. What I would
Neither
say
can I.
Is that I think this is a complicated issue.
Oh, no.
There are arguments that how can it be in order to have a really nuanced discussion of the complexities of this issue. Let me say that my own orientation as a psychiatrist, which I've been for the last 50 years, is certainly towards psychotherapy and psychoanalytically and other dynamically oriented psychotherapies, which I think always need to be part of a treatment program, even if one needs to use biological therapy, such as medication or ECT, electroconvulsive therapy. I share the point of view that was just expressed from when I started out in my career as a psychiatrist. I had certainly gained the impression that ECT was barbaric, that it would cause memory loss and so forth. And yet I discovered, and during my first year of residency training in psychiatry at the Harvard Medical School, I had a man come in who was deeply depressed and was begging to be given electric shock therapy. It's called shock therapy, but that's really a misnomer. It's an electrically induced seizure, which is done in a way that nowadays, with muscle relaxants and sedatives and so forth, is the opposite of shock. But it is an electrically induced epileptic seizure. He wanted this because he had been depressed before, and he discovered that it really rapidly and almost magically relieved his symptoms of depression. Well, I was a new and inexperienced first-year resident, and I said, well, okay, I'll consider that and talk to my supervisors, and let's hold off by making a decision, you know, for a few days while we think about it and decide what would be best for you. And he said, no way. He wasn't going to wait. So he immediately checked out of the hospital and went to one of the other hospitals in the Boston area, which my fellow residents and I used to kind of look down upon, and we called them shock factories, because they would give electroconvulsive therapy to people almost no matter what their diagnosis was. Mm-hmm. And that certainly I do not approve of. But what I did learn from this was that for some particular conditions, such as treatment resistant, severe depression, particularly when it really becomes suicidal in intensity, and you're really talking about trying to save somebody's life, I think they're really, it is important to consider it as not only a treatment that can be effective for that condition, but also is actually safer physically than the antidepressant medications. There are really fewer dangerous side effects from ECT as it is administered today, with muscle relaxants and often unilateral ECT, although the bilateral, when you have unilateral ECT, there's no risk of memory loss. But even with bilateral, it generally has been found to take dozens, if not hundreds, of ECTs before the significant memory loss shows up. However, I would say I think this is something that should be used very carefully, very sparingly. Has been found in a number of studies to be effective in relieving the most painful and acute symptoms of depression in about 80 to 85% of people, whereas even the best antidepressant medications are only effective at most in, say, perhaps 60 to 70%. So it does seem to be more effective than the medications, so the antidepressant medications, or than psychotherapy alone. Again, I would emphasize, I think it's important to have psychotherapy be part of the treatment program. I would never do just a biological treatment, whether it's pharmacological or ECT. And I think it certainly should be given only in very specific circumstances where you clearly are dealing with a life and death situation, with somebody who has just failed to respond to any other treatment. And I think it's important if one is careful and scrupulous and ethical about this, I think there is a place for it. I would say, funny, and then I'll stop talking so we can have a discussion. I would also mention that I have actually never used ECT with any of my private patients. I haven't had to, because they have all been able to recover sufficiently without that. On the other hand, I would not hesitate to recommend it for anybody who came to me for a consultation who really had tried everything else and had not succeeded. And my sense is this is the gold standard for intervention in you know, this very particular diagnostic category of treatment-resistant depression when nothing else has worked. So, again, that is my opinion. I'm totally open to, I think everything in science is always open to debate and disagreement. That's how science proceeds. So I'm perfectly happy to listen to other points of view. I'm simply presenting my own experience and my own point of view on this.
And I think so. Well, you really, you know, so what you're really saying then, I mean, for all of us, and, you know, I'm a psychotherapist, I've been practicing for over 35 years, is the importance of our really being open to any and all safe possibilities, therapeutic, interventions and therapeutic, possibilities without painting a brush over anything and saying, oh, well, this is not going to be something that would work without looking at things on a case-by-case basis? I mean, would you agree, Dr. Breeden, with that? Well, Dr. Gilligan, I think that, you know, what you're saying is that we have to be open to looking at how we are intervening with our patients on really a case-by-case basis and not assume that all medication is no good, that ECT should never be used, that there is only one way for us to provide our patients with, with good therapies. Sarah?
Hello. Yes.
The challenges of technology today, and of course, Sarah, you are someone who had elective progressive therapy, and you're a 10-year survivor, right? That's how you describe yourself.
Correct. Yes.
And you know what was really interesting is that when I was reading your bio, you said that you're a certified rehabilitation counselor, former adjunct professor, and 10-year survivor, and that after your ECT, you went to work with rehabilitation professionals and so on and so on. So, I mean, what was your experience having had the treatment and post-treatment and the impact that it has had on you, because you, like Dr. Breeden, have been somebody who's an activist. And, I was reading that you wrote a petition around the practice of ECT and had thousands of people sign it around the country, demanding that changes to this practice, if it is to continue, be radically changed.
Correct, yes. Thank you so much for giving me the opportunity to discuss this. I have a completely different perspective on shock treatment than Dr. Gilligan does.
Because I
understand that just because we use muscle relaxants and anesthesia to give people electricity does not mean that it is the opposite of a shock. In fact, it is absolutely worse because when a patient comes into the ER given in status epilepticus or having a seizure, they will actually give them a form of anesthesia to end the seizure. In this case, psychiatry has chosen to add anesthesia and muscle relaxants, which alters the seizure threshold. So in years past, before they used the, anesthesia, they would only be using 90 volts of electricity or 150 to 200 milliamps of electricity. Today's modern machines, like the Thymatron machine, uses 450 volts of electricity and 900 milliamps of electricity. So it causes all of those studies that they did back in the 50s and 60s, which demonstrated microgliosis, microhemorrhaging, myelin sheath damage with just 90 volts. Imagine magnifying that times 4 to 6. So I am aging not so gracefully with damage to my motor neurons, to my myelin sheath, and to all of the systems that are impacted by electricity, including the ion channels. So,
Dr. Gilligan, I have a question for you. I mean, just like everything has changed over very short periods, the way ECT is now administered, is it now very, very different than when Sarah was going through her ECT treatments? It sounds terrible what you're describing, Sarah. I mean, have things improved dramatically in the past 10 years?
Well, I'd say that there's no question that when ECT was first invented and was first being used, it was a much cruder and much more physically dangerous, as well as mentally, less effective than it has become over the years. This is primarily administered by neurologists, actually not psychiatrists, because it is a purely physical, event aimed at the brain. That's not involved discussion. But certainly, many of the more deleterious side effects that were part of ECT when it was first used have been recognized and changed. The whole method of ECT today is dramatically different from what it was, 50 years ago, or 30 years ago, or 20 years ago.
I'm only
saying this is it's not the first thing I would use. I would certainly want to begin with other approaches, but I'm concerned about people who really are desperate and are really suicidal and are suffering from such severe pain from their depression that they are eager for anything that will relieve the pain. And for that, ECT, I think, has been shown to be capable of really releasing a lot of people from the pain of their illness.
So, Sarah, I mean, the unfortunate thing, I mean, there are a number of unfortunate things that occurred as a result of your ECT treatment. But, for example, if, God forbid, you or somebody who had severe clinical depression and where nothing was working, not the medication, not the psychotherapy, not the combination, from what I'm gathering is that the procedure is a completely different type of procedure. It is done very differently than it was 10 years ago, and that it was just unfortunate that they did not have the technology 10 years ago that we have today, so that it would be done in a way where you would not have to have suffered in the way that you've actually suffered. I mean, and Dr. Breeden, would you agree with that? That we have to look at that there have been some real positive things that have happened technologically speaking in the last number of years. But go ahead, Sarah.
Well, it's interesting because psychiatry frequently says that so many changes have happened. In reality, the only change that has happened is the introduction of anesthesia and muscle relaxants. ECT has never, ever even had phase one animal studies. They have never established protocols. They have never established safety measures that are specific to developing standardized methodological operational procedures. So every single doctor who does it plays with their own dials and their own seven variables, doing it their own way. It's not like an antibiotic where there's a specific dose and a specific amount of times. There are seven independent variables, and each of those independent variables are recognized by the APA for causing permanent, lasting brain damage. So if you're someone like me who gets the luck of the draw and gets five of those independent variables, which have never been established, regulated, you get a medical Russian roulette. I do have two friends who swear that their lives were saved by it. However, one of those people is now also experiencing delayed electrical injury, just like me. And that person is only had 13 treatments.
Are you saying then that you said that in the fall of 2018 was when you started to begin to experience what you've described as delayed neurological issues which you attribute, and which may be, of course, correct, to the treatments that you had received, you know, 10 years prior.
Yes. Low-voltage electrical injury is associated highly with what's called delayed electrical injury, the neurological sequelae of low-voltage electrical injury. And we're giving people this treatment as a ditch, last desperate Hail Mary, but we have to consider that even the research from Harold Sackham, the man who touts himself as the father of shock treatment, he says that the treatment only lasts for, he said, 2 weeks after, and sometimes up to 6 months after. So we are putting people in a situation where we're offering them, essentially prescribing them a traumatic brain injury, getting them punch drunk in an effort to alter their mental status and help them, quote, forget how bad their life was, and somehow feel better momentarily, and then give them more later in the maintenance.
Now, Dr. Gilligan, you were saying that there, with the later and latest ways of doing this, that there has been minimal loss. Is that true?
Well, certainly many of the adjustments to ECT over time have minimized any measurable or identifiable neurological damage, such as memory loss, which tends to show up only after a person has had dozens and dozens or even hundreds. Well, one thing I would agree with, though, with the other person who was talking about this, I really think that ECT, of course, should only be given voluntarily. It should only be given if somebody wants it and agrees to it and has had it explained to them what it involves, what the methods are, and what the you know, what the research literature shows about the effectiveness and the side effects. I mean, I think it should be a completely free choice on the part of anybody. As I said, my first exposure to it was from somebody who wanted it when I was reluctant to use it. But that he realized from his own past experience that it really had been an immediately effective. Now, the person who was just speaking was absolutely correct that the benefits are only temporary. Depression can come back. Of course, that's true with almost any kind of treatment. And all I can say is, you know, if and when there is a resumption of the symptoms that led to any kind of therapy, whether it's psychotherapy or pharmacotherapy or electric convulsive therapy, if there's a renewed need for it, then yes, then you start all over from the beginning, discussing is this something that the individual understands and is agreed to go on with. And I think it has to be done in the context of what I call a therapeutic alliance between somebody who's suffering from severe mental anguish and a professional psychiatrist whom they trust and are willing to work with. But I certainly would agree that I think we don't want to impose this on anybody. I think it should be an absolutely voluntary choice, of course.
So was this an absolutely voluntary choice on your part when you first, I mean, I'm assuming, made the decision to have the ECT?
The strange thing about my experience is that it was initially given to me because I was catatonic. They did not recognize that I actually had hepatic encephalopathy from too much ammonia in my system because my body could not process the Depakote that had been prescribed. So my parents were given the information. If you look at the information my parents were given, they were told that I would have transient memory loss. And that would probably just involve the day before of the treatment. And that my worst side effect would be the headache. Now, my signature is on the informed consent form, which means they felt I was capable of signing my own consent. But the interesting thing to note is I do have a very vivid memory of the last time I signed that consent form, and it was while I was in restraints on the gurney as they were starting my IV. So I think not only was I not given informed consent, because on every single informed consent paperwork, when they ask me to write in what the worst side effect could be, I wrote in a headache.
Wow. Then, how old were you when
they started you had this treatment? When I was 27, I think, and then I quit against medical advice when I was 34, and it took an additional 2 years to begin to create new memories. And so basically I have lost 95% of my memory. Of the first 36 years of my life, I have no memories from which to draw consolation when I am sad. No memories of family vacations or high school friends or even college experiences. No memories of my grandparents. No memories.
Well, I mean, you have really suffered as a result of having gone through the.
I have, and I think the worst.
You have, yes.
It's the type of suffering that cannot be captured on a scan. They purposefully do not. Just because you say it's not there because it's not captured on the scan, they're refusing me things like a functional MRI. They're refusing me appropriate assessments like a PET to look at the amount of gliosis that I have. But you can hear it in my voice. I have dysarthria.
You're doing. Let me tell you something. I know you were concerned about the interview. You're doing great. You sound great. You're articulate. So, and you're getting your message across, which is something that's really important. I want to ask you, Dr. Breeding, something. We've been talking about, of course, Sarah, who had the treatment done a number of years ago. The people who you are in contact with who have had ECT or who are, you know, perhaps thinking about having ECT, are they experiencing similar kinds of after effects to the procedure?
Can you hear me now, Beatty?
Yes.
Can you hear me? Okay, great. It was very frustrating for me. I couldn't get through for some reason. Let me just say, first of all, that I think you guys kind of overrode Sarah's first point, you know, where she was saying that Dr. Gilligan's really misleading when he was saying that about this newer, safer electroshock. You know, she was really making the point that he was saying, yes, it is true that you don't have the broken bones and the broken teeth and stuff from the grand mal convulsion without muscle relaxants and anesthesia. But the main damage is the brain damage, which is due to the electricity and the cell death from the heat and electrical and mechanical damage and the effects of a grand mal convulsion, which all medicine tries to protect people from that because they know it causes damage. But this is one branch of medicine that's deliberately inducing grand mal convulsions with even greater amounts of electricity. And so Dr. Gilligan's very misinformed when he assumes that there's, you know, no brain damage or no memory loss, because that's just absolutely false, and the science is very clear.
Let me just ask, are you saying misinformed or informed? That you said that Dr. Gilligan is misinformed about the
misinformed
current
yeah.
practice?
Yeah, because even the shock proponents acknowledge that Yes, it causes brain damage. Yes, it causes memory loss, which is the neurologist's main indicator of brain damage. It's just a matter of how much, you know. And then you do a risk-benefit analysis and say, is the brain damage worth the effect of whatever benefit you might get? But there's always brain damage and there's always memory loss. It's just a matter of how much.
And Dr. Gilligan, do you want to respond? Do you want to respond?
Wait. He had a chance to talk a lot. Let me say a couple of more things while I got him.
Okay.
And, you know, Dr. Gilligan was also bringing up certain anecdotal stuff and making this argument about suicide. But there actually are significant research studies that show that electroshock does not prevent suicide, and I can certainly present anecdotes from my own experience of people who killed themselves as a result of the despair they felt about the memory loss and other cognitive deficits that they had a result of electroshock. So that cuts both ways. Now, just in answer to your basic question, do the shock survivors that I've talked to report significant memory loss? Yes, definitely. And they do, and that's often profound. There's two types of effects. You know, there's retrograde amnesia, which is what Sarah was referring to, where you lose memories of your childhood or past events. You know, typically it's most severe for the period surrounding the electroshock, but it often goes further and further back. The second thing is what they call anterograde memory loss, and that's in plain speech that's referred to more as a learning disability or a cognitive deficit. So people report over and over again that they're not as able to solve problems, they're not as able to remember things, and most of them end up making sure of carrying a notebook, a notepad, or whatever to write things down and kind of try to compensate for their cognitive deficits as a result. And that's just common. That happens routinely. And so there's all kinds of other effects. Some people actually end up with a seizure disorder that they did not have prior to the shocks as a result of having shocks. Now, certainly it's very different if you have, you know, 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6 shocks. You know, the effects are cumulative, and so the more shock, the more damage. That's absolutely true. This has never been approved for anything by the regulatory agencies, except they finally said, well, maybe it's severe catatonia or whatever, but it gets used a lot and it damages a lot of people. And the last thing I want to say, and I know I'm talking a little bit because I'm trying to catch up, is that my view on it, I have an article about this on our website, endofshock.com. But is that there can hardly even be any authentic informed consent for many reasons. You know, one is that where there's a threat of involuntary, voluntary becomes
right.
And that's what typically happens here. You know, and then the second thing is what Sarah was talking about. You know, when you're under the effects of mood altering drugs, you know, when you're in a desperate and despairing place,
exactly.
You know,
I totally agree. We're hardly in a place to be able to give rational, informed consent, that's for sure. But Dr. Gilligan, what is your response to this?
Well, I certainly would say that there's no medical treatment that doesn't have deleterious and dangerous side effects. Let me give you another example. I've had a heart valve replaced in my heart because it needed to be replaced. I would have died if they hadn't done it. On the other hand, because they did it, I have to take anticoagulant treatments so that the artificial heart valve doesn't cause me to have a stroke, which could again cause brain damage and could kill me. The point of the surgery, of course, was to save my life, which fortunately it has done. This was done in 2001, so I've survived for 19 years very well with it. On the other hand, I have to take anticoagulants constantly. I can sometimes have abnormal bleeding. I know that I am at much higher risk of having a stroke than I would be if I had not had the heart surgery. And I'd say the same is true of electroconvulsive therapy or any single other treatment that any doctor uses to treat any disease. There's no medicine that doesn't have side effects. So the question here is a cost-benefit analysis, and that's why I think clinicians and patients need to be very careful about what they're going to utilize. The one thing I would say about ECT is it has been found to be actually safer than the antidepressant medications in terms of most of the dangerous side effects. And the memory loss, it's been really impossible for many people to document until somebody has had dozens or even 100 ECT treatments. At the same time, as I said before, I've never had to use ECT with any of my private patients, although I certainly would if I felt that somebody was so was suffering from pain that was of depression that was so unbearable that they couldn't tolerate it, and they had not responded to psychotherapy and medication. I would certainly recommend it. It's not something I would subject anybody to involuntarily. Finally, I just would say that any medical treatment there is can be misused, and there's no question about that. That's why we have malpractice suits in medicine and surgery. If doctors don't respect, the accepted and rational results of the best research that's been done, and they subject their patients to unnecessary risks of harm or actual harm, then we have procedures for dealing with that. But I don't think it makes sense to simply prohibit ECT, unless and until there were any definitive evidence that the risks far outweigh any possible benefits.
Well, I think we could all continue to talk more and more about American mental health across the board, of which I am a real strong critic. You see people having 45-minute sessions as if that's therapy, 30-minute sessions, 10-minute med interventions. It's absurd. So there's a lot more that I think we could all talk about, over and above, ECT, that I think could be really, really helpful and informative to, to people around the world.